Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com. If we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, predecided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look at these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make, if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedies in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, I thank you so very much for your time taken to give us a good disclaimer and a little background on who we are and what we do. Tonight's guest speaker, as promised, is Brother John. And tonight's topic of discussion is actually going to be preemptive positioning prior to getting yourself in trouble, or as I like to call it, becoming judgment-proof. What you're going to learn tonight is the next step after you have acquired what Bernie offers you on the Saturday call. We've been focusing for the last month or so with John on the Monday night calls and how those things will affect you and how, you know, John is working behind the scenes on correcting the status with regards to employing it in litigation, teaching you the rules of litigation and how to operate and using supplying teaching syllabus material such as briefs and other types of filings that you may come across. So tonight we're going to switch gears and talk about the corporation soul and the charitable religious trust and how by prepositioning yourselves ahead of the curve, it works to your benefit, number one. And number two, because you're operating through a corporation soul, you're actually able to bring someone or someone's into your trust or into your corporation soul to defend it. Much like hiring an attorney, if you would, except you're not hiring a member of the bar. You would be hiring an information provider to do what's necessary directly, rather than through you, which is typically how it's mostly done. So without further ado, it is my sincere pleasure to turn this call over to Brother John.
Good evening, Michael. Thank you for that kind and gracious introduction. I'll try to live up to the gracious accolades you've afforded me.
Just make sure you get the $20 in the mail to me, that's all.
You accept Visa?
Yeah, I do, as a matter of fact.
Look, lady, we'd love to help you out. Which way did you come in? Yeah. Right. Request right. Lines are open. Next victim, please. I mean, next caller. I mean, next student, please. Many of you will remember back then a young man, Senator Ted Kennedy, back in 1969, in an incident regarding the Chappaquiddick, on or about 11:15 p.m. on the evening of July 18th, 1969, he was driving a young lady home, Mary Jo Kopic, he said he was going to take her over to the ferry. Somehow, he left the main road was on a side road and ended up leaving the bridge into the vehicle resulted in the pond in the Pukta Pond just off the side of that bridge. Now Ted was able to swim clear, but he says he tried to get Mary Jo Kropetkin out of the vehicle, but couldn't. They had been drinking. There was a significant concern over that. But that was on or about 11:30 or 11:15 p.m. On Friday night, July 18th. Ted Kennedy left the scene and was later charged as that was one of his crimes, is leaving the scene. But he did not appear till after 10 o'clock the next morning. In those hours, in between the time that, in those 10 and a half hours between the time that his vehicle left the roadway, he had a death of a young lady. Ted, it was the strangest thing. When he turned himself in, he didn't own anything. There was his mansion, his house, all of his vehicles, boats, etc. He didn't own any of them. In fact, all the paperwork had somehow managed to be filed to transfer every single vehicle and vessel and property out of Ted's name. So what happened was that Ted, when the family went to sue, they, oops, holy broken tree feathers, Batman, found out there was nothing to sue. They left him alone. He was charged, convicted, and received a 2-month sentence, suspended jail sentence. He pled guilty to leaving the scene, and there was a handful of other things that was that related to it. But here's something that's very interesting: even the vehicle that was involved in the crash, he, on Monday morning, did not own it. There was enough influence that over the weekend they managed to get the motor vehicle department to up in Massachusetts to cover all the registries so that that vehicle was in a trust. That it was the only thing that was in that trust, so that the vehicle and the liability that went with it were exclusively in the trust that didn't hold anything else. Fast forward to 1977. I was at a litigation where I was at law school in Southern California, and they were the professors would regularly invite some of the students to go with them to visit hearings or debates or different adjudications or to negotiations regarding some of the cases that they were currently involved with. Every single professor that I had the honor and privilege of setting under had an active law practice or had recently retired from an active law practice, every one of them. And none of them were none of them were just jurisprudence that had never practiced law. And over a third of them had served as justice or even chief justice at one of them before retiring and becoming a professor. This one case, they were trying to sue the family of this young man who had an accident. A lady coming out of a supermarket sped out of the supermarket and actually ran over the center divider and broadsided the young man, almost killing him. But this family, what they did was they went, she said that it was acting in an erratic manner, and so they were suing for back then $4 million, which was an awful lot of money back in 1977. And for, you know, emotional injury, you know, and all the related compensatory damages, et cetera. And they were even trying to seek $2 million trouble damages so that the little boy wouldn't do it again, a 17-year-old. They, the family had six children. They lived in a very nice house in a town called Downey, California. Some of you may have heard of it. That's where the space shuttle was built. That's where the Apollo moon capsule was built. That's where the B-1 bomber, you know, et cetera, all of those. And that's where the P-51 Mustang was built. And but what happened was is that after about 7 hours of just arduous planning and arguing and everything else, one of the paralegals said she just got off the phone with the Los Angeles County and come to find out that this family did not own the property that they were in. And it was a $1.6 million property that they were attempting to take. They come to find out that none of the cars they own, they were all in eight different trusts. The house, the cars, and among other things, the guns that they had in the house. Nonetheless, this long 7.5 hour, almost 8 hour arduous beating, or I mean meeting, and that's what it felt like, was a beating. Everybody shook their heads and, holy shaving cream, Batman, we can't sue these guys. You can't make a turnip bleed. The Volkswagen Beetle that the kid was driving, it wasn't even in his name. Turns out that the family, many years earlier, before they started to raise their children, had started to put everything they had in trust, or in one case, the house was actually in the Corpsol, but everything else was in trust. Corpsols weren't really used like we use them now, but this family, and unlike most, they were involved in active ministry. They worked with three different churches in the local area. Five of their six children were involved actively in churches and full-time ministry. And in an attempt a year and a half later, they to refile, the judge says, I'm sorry, but you have to state a claim for which relief can be granted. You're seeking money from, there's nothing here. What are you trying to do? You know, you're trying to sue them. What, I'm just, he says, I'm just curious. And I happen to know the judge because he was one of my law professors. He says, what's your goal here? You're just trying to get an empty judgment? He says, it might not be good to waste my time. That might make me very upset. And the judge said that from the bench. This lady's husband non-suited. And they walked away. Move forward 4 years. We're in a huge boardroom, 42 lawyers, actual attorneys, California bar attorneys, in this huge boardroom near the Industry Hills Sheridan, on the same hill in Southern California there, of a huge corporation. They were trying to evaluate how long they could infringe upon this couple in Pennsylvania's patent rights before, and how much damage or defense this family could generate before they realized that they that the family realized what happened, or the corporation had saturated the market and then was going to non-suit for no further infringement. Well, amidst this, there were arguments where the individuals, these 42 attorneys, there were little paralegals and others doing investigations, and there were four of us there that were invited by a judge, back then Judge Hamilton, to observe, you know, and see what was happening. And we all signed NCNDs and NCNDAs and confidentiality agreements as we went in there. And you would not believe it, but about a third of the families that they were going to go after, that they were going to try to, their assets were not their own. They were somebody else's. They were trusts and corporations, and now what we would call charitable religious trusts. And what happened was that it drastically affected this corporation's decisions on how they were going to attack these people that they had done nothing wrong. They had a wonderful, cutesy little piece of technology that was very applicable back then in California in the oil field industry, as California was just starting their march against oil field air polluters, and the SCA QMD, South Coast Air Quality Management District, and CARB had just come into effect only 18 months earlier, California Air Resources Board. But this, it drastically affected the way they were being handled. Last week I mentioned a young 61-year-old lady named Rose, who after the first time the IRS had come after her about her husband's issue, and it was wrongful. We got it abated, but what happened was that we put her house in a corpse sole, and the two cars, her husband's old car and hers, into a trust. And a year and 10 months later, the IRS came back, and they were black Suburbans and white Suburbans, as well, as the big thing. And they started, you know, they had warrants, they had writs of attachment and writs of possession, except that by, you know, Rose was having a little bit of a tough time. They finally let her make a phone call. This is long before the days of cell phones. But got over there, and I had copies of all the charitable religious trusts. And I asked them what they were doing, and they says, well, we're going after – I'm sorry, but this – you know, we've got a judgment, and we're seizures. I says, whose property are you taking? Well, this lady's and her deceased husband's. I says, this house doesn't belong to her. And she says, yeah, the lady was saying something about that too, you know, and they were loading both cars up on, back then, the brand new models of Jardin wreckers, the kind that, you know, don't drag the vehicle behind, but they sit on a little a platform on the flatbed. And I says, those cars don't belong to her either. And I think these people are going to be, you know, the trustees for those are going to be a little bit upset that you stole their vehicle. No, you can't. This is a theft. Why don't you go pull the registration out of those vehicles right there? And the lady that was staying there left the special agent, treasury agent, and she went over, and they had these old spring wound kind of things that wrapped around the steering column that held the back then the registrations in them, and she bought them over, and she says, he's right. He says, these aren't registered to them, and they've got the correct license number and everything on here. And he says, call the DMV immediately. She did. She went in and used Rose's phone, and about half an hour later come out and says, they don't own these cars. These cars, here's the entities they belong to. And by the time they got done, there was nothing that they could take with them. They packed up and left. they never actually dismissed the complaint against Rose. They never actually washed away the debt. But because there was no reason for them to come after it, she went to her grave peacefully without ever being bothered by them ever again. Many, many years ago, Justice Breshears and I, back in the mid-90s, I changed the corpse soul that I had to a new one called Household of Faith Ministries, and it was a Washington corpse soul, and I had a registered agent in Washington we put all my assets into it, and into some of the trusts, but the property I had went into the we put it in Household of Faith Ministries. Now, push forward all the way up to just 2.5 years ago, almost 3 years ago, we were doing a project for, and I shared this on a previous call, where we were doing an outreach for the Houston Northwest Chamber of Commerce to inaugurate this new park, the Kikarilla Missioner Park, in Northwest Houston. And amidst everything, there was a slip and fall, and I actually, out of the corner of my eye, witnessed it, and went over to help the person immediately, and they denied help, and I indicated that I had some medical training, and they still refused, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Something seemed a little funny, but as the events got started, the ambulance hadn't quite got there yet, and so I took a few moments from the podium to near early morning hours before we were starting, and it was raining. It was raining heavily outside, and there was a plastic material on the underneath the canopy that people could walk on. It was non-skip, and we prayed for this gentleman. Well, 7 weeks later, Houston Northwest Chamber of Commerce got hit with this horrible multi-million dollar lawsuit for the slip and fall. This guy is claiming injuries and injuries and injuries, and there were some problems with it. Right from the start, I says, well, here, we need to get you on something dry here. He says, no, don't move him. I says, why? He says, he knows what he's doing. You know, he's been through this many times before. Whoops. Okay. That wasn't really the clinker. What happened was that there were 9 defendants. Richard's Party Rentals, where they rented the canopy from the hospital that part of the property was on, St. Luke's Hospital. There was a Houston Northwest Cycling Association that advertised it. Oh, they took names and handed out subpoenas to anybody that had anything to do with it, with the outreach. And so what happened was that each time when we were at depositions or at any hearings, they were accusing this person, that person. I was the one that was in charge of the facilities, actually. For the Houston Northwest Chamber of Commerce, and I took responsibility for everything, you know, and I say, oh, that was me, you know, that, et cetera, you know, and oh, that decision was mine, or oh, on that one, actually, I was acting under orders, but this is based on this decision here, and they got down to the point where I was the one remaining piece of meat, defendant on the table, that they were trying to pursue. And all of a sudden, when the attorney group for the other side realized that I didn't actually own anything, they timidly went after the bond, the $1 million bond that Houston Chamber, Northwest Chamber of Commerce had. And because I had volunteered they offered to try to compensate me, but they never did. They tried to reimburse my expenses, and when it even came down to expenses, I had $2,873 worth of expenses, and I was told that there was only $1,000 left in the budget and that that would have to be it. So I gave them two receipts that totaled $1,200-something from Home Depot and accepted the $1,000. And this attorney and his wife that are cross-examining me says, "You mean you didn't even get reimbursed?" And, well, how dare you, you know? And then they learned that they says, "We, by the way, we tried to serve you, and your address is very wrong." He says, "There's some burned out hulk of a building there." And I says, "Please be kind." "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, that's my house." I says, "That's your house?" He says, "No, no, no, no." He says, "You, you know, you see that motorhome in the picture up front? That's where I'm living right now. And the fact that this is where I'm calling you from," and I turned the laptop around and when we were on the Zoom call, you know, in the interrogation, and I panned it around, and it was like, holy broken tree feathers, Batman. And because I had not claimed any income, et cetera, and it was we were donating it, and I'd never sent anybody a bill, under Texas statutory law, the maximum they could seek for damages for anything is $500,000. Well, the ambulance chaser took 384 of the $500,000, before taxes, and the plaintiff ended up getting, $42,000 after paying the taxes. They walked away with almost nothing and a year and a half's worth of work on this thing. But, what happened was is that they didn't even bother to try to get a judgment against me. They couldn't. There was nothing, there was any value there to get. I still do not-for-profit work. We take care of churches, schools, 501c3 not-for-profit organizations. We donate our time to help all kinds of hospitals and clinics, et cetera. But we actually use our corporation soul and our charitable religious trust for ministry reasons. There's an old saying, "He is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to have what can never be taken away." This short-term wealth, okay, that's what it is. You talk about comfortable debentures for retirement. Well, it says, who has given up houses, riches, inheritance, gold, silver, family, friends, or loved ones that they will not be rewarded tenfold in the kingdom to come? And this is the son, the kid, saying this. You know, I don't know how many of you are believe in an intelligent designer or a higher power. I do. I'm a physicist. I saw the boat frame in the mountains of Ararat in satellite footages before the volcano erupted and carried it down and broke it into multiple pieces. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm a former conspirer. While I was at law school, I was paying for my school, working for the Defense Department. After I got out of the Air Force in 76, I ended up back in work in the same department, same places that I worked at when I was there, except now I wasn't having to wear a uniform. But that's how I worked my way through law school. I have seen that rock split in half, part way up the side of a mountain in the middle of nowhere, 93 miles from the next nearest source of water, that you can tell where the water flowed from that rock. And you never notice on a stream bed when, you know, the pebbles that are in the stream are smooth and round and they look like they've been through a rock polisher, but the ones on the shore are kind of jagged. Well, the evidence where there must have been a throng of water coming from that rock for many years that is still there to this day. And Google Earth photoshops it out now, but it used to be able to see it. I believe in that higher power. And to that end, you know, I try to be a good steward with whatever has been placed at my rest. The Father, I'd like to believe I've gotten a teeny bit of wisdom from him, and that's the wisdom that I'm sharing with you. There's an old saying, it says, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. The originator of that was a baseball player and coach he used to encourage his team every practice with that. And to that end, may I humbly submit that if you fail to plan, you're planning to fail. And though you're not at war, the tip of the spear best be sharp. Maybe you don't have anybody pursuing you right now, but unlike Ted Kennedy, most of us are not as fiscally well-heeled, and we don't have the circles of influence that go all the way up to the Massachusetts Department of Motor Vehicles, so that by Monday morning, not even the vehicle that was pulled out of the river there, or the hooked a pond, is in our name. And so to that end, it's very, very important that we plan ahead. Some people say, John, you know, you've had that Corp Soul for how many years? What have you done with it? Well, I just, you know, it's been, you know, the assets are, you know, protected. But I've been using it mostly for ministry reasons. It wouldn't be till 26 years later after getting it, and all these years of maintaining it and keeping up the fees and, you know, the registration, the registration fees, that this property is now, that when I originally bought it was for $72,000, that is now worth close to $500,000, would have any need to for protection, and all of a sudden now nothing gets touched. If you think that attorneys and these ambulance chasers are dumb and ignorant, think again. Some of them just never got a chance at a good payday, and they're entrepreneurs just waiting, looking for a fish to bite on, or, you know, morticians say the early worm gets the bird, but they haven't cashed in and got their payday yet. Well, they're trying to figure out how to make a cash in and a payday out of you. So with that, think about carefully how you might protect yourself and your family and the assets that you have, so that it's true, there are sometimes things later on in life that take everything you have down and leaves you with the change in your pocket. I have also done that myself. 7 years ago, on Memorial Day, we lost everything in a fire. And so I know what it's like to lose everything, and I mean totally and completely. It's an interesting experience to learn to have your attitude adjusted by getting yourself off of your physical possessions and onto eternal focus, and at the same time being good steward with what you have with your physical possessions, that intelligent designer may have put at your rest, is very important and very, very good. I'll leave you with this one last thing. There's something called the acid test of ownership to prove whether you own something or you don't. And the acid test is this. I want each and every one of you right now to pick out something that you think you own. And I'm using the word think. Whether it's your wristwatch or your wallet your glasses or your laptop or the cell phone you're talking on. Now, here's the test. If you either bought it with you when you came to this rock, or you can take it with you when you leave, then you the man, or you the girl, you the owner, you the king. But if you didn't either bring it with you when you came to this rock, or you can't take it with you when you leave, then it kind of begs a question, doesn't it? Who is the owner? Is that the guy with the sheep and the cattle on 1,000 hills and all the gold and silver they're in? You know, that intelligent designer? So, as you live your life and as you work with your asset protection, just remember, that guy, we're just the custodians. He may still be the owner, but he is sure pleased when you do well with what is he has placed at your rest. That makes him very proud. Make the king proud.
Great story.
Back to you, Michael. Great.
Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. All questions are invited tonight, whether it's about asset protection or it's about correcting your status. Remember, keep in mind that the point of this discussion tonight is the remedies that are available once these are established and you are coming into conflict where you need to use them, because John here is the one that would be your lead instructor on how to use them. In fact, with trusts, and he can step in with temporary power of attorney and do them and handle the matter for you in that instance. So press star 2 on your keypad, and for those of you on Freedoms Radio, simply look to the center right of your monitor. You will see a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side, empty. Left click into it, type away your comment or question. On the outside of that rectangle, underneath, you'll see a place to put your name and information, and then just hit submit, and I'll be glad to give voice to your comment or question. So again, press star 2 on your keypad. We don't want to have a short call tonight. Let's go check Freedoms Radio real quick while you're thinking about pushing that button. And that's star 2, not pound 2, star. Stand by. It just takes a moment for my screen to refresh, so give me a minute here. You know, the same thing happened last night, John, at the end, towards the end of the evening when we were doing Q&A. My machine just did a pause. Bernie says that I need to ask your son to make me something special. Well, while we're waiting for my machine to refresh, go ahead and keep sharing if you like. You can change gears and talk about anything you want.
The I was going to go back to the Ted Kennedy event there with Mary Jo Kopechne's situation. There were the family wanted to very, very much crucify him. And there were ambulance chasers that had made it very clear that they were prepared to assist with any legal support that they needed for the family. Now, at this juncture, when they were dragging that Oldsmobile back out of the pond there, most of those people didn't realize that at that juncture the young Ted Kennedy that that vehicle wasn't even in his name anymore. And there were individuals that they took pictures of the car and everything else, and they were prepared to follow up with that. But all of a sudden, when they realized that there was nothing to be had, even the swell of a public opinion died. And it turns out that there were some attorneys that had been working with local press, et cetera, that to keep the anger against the Kennedys stirred, so that by the time they got time, it was later revealed that they were doing this so that by the time it came to jury selection and voir dire, that everybody would be so angry at the Kennedys that there was nothing short of multi-million-dollar settlement that they could get out of it. Well, when it was realized that none of that was there, the collateral character assassination of the Kennedys also ceased. So there's when things are properly protected, there's a lot to go with that, and it can go much, much deeper than most people realize. The protection that you put in place now, it's something that, like I said earlier, though that you're not at war, the tip to spear best be sharp. Though you don't need it now, hopefully, maybe someday, you'll be passing on the stewardship to maybe your children or your grandchildren, and you will have never needed it, and that'll be a beautiful thing. I have already been to the place where I have been thankful that something was protected, and not just on my behalf, but on the behalf of good friends. Michael?
Yep, thank you. Again, ladies and gentlemen, press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. Otherwise, we're going to have a short call tonight. I want to welcome Johnny Ringo. Johnny is the former lead investigator for the late Tony Davis. It's always a pleasure to have him on the call, and I just like to acknowledge him whenever I see him join us. The first question comes from Harold. Go ahead, Harold.
Michael, hi, John. My question is, you hear all kinds of stuff going on about the U.S. dollar going down and all that. Is the money that's in the bank of a corporation sold any safer than the bank that's in a personal banking account?
That's a good question, Harold. May I ask you a couple of questions in response to that?
Sure.
You said the money that's in the bank, and then you said the money that's in the bank that the Corp Sol has. All those nickels are still in the same bank, aren't they?
Yes.
Now, let me ask you a question.
Separate account. Okay.
When it comes to the banking, even if we're dealing with the real nickels or real dollars, are the nickels or the dollars all stacked in the same place but only sorted out electronically, or are they in individual boxes with everybody's individual name on it?
Well, they're inside of the checking account or whatever.
Yeah, there's any Federal Reserve notes or any coin in there is all stacked together and grouped together, much like what they did with the Social Security back in the 70s and 80s. So they grouped it all into the general fund when originally each and everybody's individual name, there was an account for every single person that had a socialist insecurity number, I mean a Social Security number. Did he say that out loud? I'm certain his lips were moving. What happens is that the nickels are the nickels, and if something's going to get seized, it used to be that the copper was about the only thing that was left that had any intrinsic value, but now it's copper-clad aluminum, and so there's really no coinage or paper with intrinsic value. It's all fiat currency, and to that end, that was necessary by the those that manipulate the money to take intrinsic value currency off the market and put something that was fiat so that they could establish the specific value of it for the purposes of managing money worldwide. And this one of these evenings, what we'll do is we'll go over something that, and I'll call it old Roman money. And maybe we'll just title that evening's discussion old Roman money. But what happens is that they cannot, you know, there's an old saying, if you control the food, you control the people. If you control the water, you can control the people. If you control the weapons, you can control the people. If you can control the travel, you can control the people. If you can control the currency, you can control the people. Any one of those. And these folks, much to their own chagrin, because sometimes, you know, they actually believe their own press. They believe if they control the currency, they control the people, and they've tried to. And the problem is that people sometimes find a way to do business outside of them, outside of themselves. Me personally, there's a Ace Hardware store and a few other stores around here that, and some supermarkets that, for many years, every so often I'll walk in with silver coinage or gold coinage, and I'll say, "Hey, what do you got here? You know, what can I buy with this today?" And I talk to the assistant manager, the manager, and in some cases the owner. And over the years, I've gotten to the place where they know who I am. And some of them, they see me walk in the store, and they'll say, "Hey, John, here's what the spot is today. I'll tell you what, I'll give you plus 5% for that coin you got in your hand, you know, toward groceries or toward hardware." And they, have learned to work around it. To that end, when the money gets crashed, it's the same way that those folks that managed the, that propped up the stock market so they could pull out the critical stocks in such a way and withdraw their money from the banks so that in 1929, they precipitated a fear-driven event that we call the stock market crash of 1929. And to precipitate a national bankruptcy, or excuse me, let me rephrase that, the appearance of a national bankruptcy, and these four families took Winston Churchill aside many years earlier and showed him their plans for what would be the first international games and then the second international games, and how they were going to, between the first and the second international games, crash the U.S. economy and try to bring them under the slavery of an animal that they called, that author G. Edward Griffin calls the creature from Jekyll Island, or the Federal Reserve Board. And it's the same old thing, Howard, that's been going on for years. There's some people with a little bit of power, and a little bit of power corrupts a little bit, but a lot of bit of power corrupts a lot, and money's power. The more money you have, the more corrupt you can be. But they would like to control it all. But it comes down to this, Howard. We are born, we have a chance to make a choice, and then we die and you go to glory and or elsewhere. These folks, there's an old saying, it says, a stingy man only gets wealth. You know, because when you stand in glory, none of that goes with you. And every one of these people that have conspired to control the world's currency, when the date on their time card comes due, and each one of us have an expiration date. There's nobody that doesn't. And when that date, the passbook account of life that had the hours and minutes and seconds that were put into it by the intelligent designer are gone, you're done. And that acid test of ownership, what you take with you, you know, it says if you've made deposits in eternity, you take it with you. You know, if you haven't, then oops. If it was all here, you all got left behind. And those people, they're going to try to crash the economy for their own benefit. And let's face it, 1929 was very, very bad. 1991 was very bad. You know, remember we had people jumping off of buildings in Florida even, you know, in 1991. And there's been a few dips in the economy over the years, over the last, not just a couple hundred, but the last few thousand, where people got afraid. And they start getting fearful, and they got excited, and then their heart got sick, and some of them even jumped from buildings to take their own lives. But you know what? Art, you and I are still here, aren't we? Our grandparents were still there, too. No matter how bad the crash occurred, you know, somehow we managed to live through it, didn't we? Oops. You know, that doesn't fit the demographic of what those world money managers would like to believe, does it? So, your money, it may or may not be safe. There's an old saying about having coinage that has intrinsic value. That, regardless of whether the market crashes or not, still has some value. And even after the fire that took our place, yeah, I went looking through the soot and the ashes for that kind of that heavy metal. And most of it all survived, you know. And it helped out immensely. But I knew that there are no such thing as accidents. You and I may not see it on our day planner, but that intelligent designer, it's on his day planner. It wasn't an accident. In fact, he may have even let that funny guy with the pitchfork and the funny pointed tail, he may have even given him permission to do it. And so if something crummy or bad happens, if it's already been approved by the intelligent designer from the head office, all I can say is, you know, the only thing I do is just, John or Spanky, buckle up, Spanky. This one's coming from downtown. It's already approved. Well, I get excited, you know, just it's going to happen. Let's just work and live through it.
So it's okay to have silver in the corporation soul. I mean, it's better to have it in the corporation soul than fiat money.
I agree with that 100%.
Where to store it? That's the next problem.
I don't want to know where you store it.
No, I know.
The question?
Okay.
Yeah. Whether you have one of those little nice OD green ammo cans and you put it in there and you bury it in the backyard or whatever you do with it, whether you one person, he was kind of laughing. I says, what's the matter? He says, he was telling me that he just, he rode his bicycle across the bridge, up, on the Canadian U.S. border, and he pulled off the clamp on the seat, and down inside the seat post were a whole bunch of Canadian silver coins. And I says, what is that? Did you just ride that car? He says, no, you don't understand. He says, I keep them there all the time. He says, this is my little bank. And I says, how much is in there worth? Well, the current weight of silver, probably about $3,000 worth. I said, that's kind of an expensive bicycle. But that's where he kept some of his silver. Mm-hmm. You know, so some place that's accessible. If it's inside of an institution that can have doors that can lock, that means they can be locked against your entry also. And there's times in the past, many, many times already, when an order was issued, an edict was issued that nobody was to withdraw anything, and that includes safe deposit boxes from institutions, you know, for whatever reasons, and not just in this country. So if you happen to have some, you know, even if it's just a little vacant spot in the heel of your shoe, you know, hey, you know, Godspeed, and, you know, that's a great place to keep something that could get your tail out of a pencil sharpener if you got in trouble, Howard.
Yeah, okay. Okay, thanks for your opinion. Thanks, John.
All righty. Next is Johnny Ringo, followed by Brian, and then Kent. Go ahead, Johnny Ringo.
I'll be your Huckleberry. I'll be your Huckleberry.
You there, Johnny? Let's try pressing the button again. All right. Go back to where I was. Hold on.
Beneficial reading for everybody.
There we go. Now, Johnny, start over. I just now got you unmuted.
Oh, okay. Well, I'd like to thank you, first of all, for the acknowledgement. And second of all, there's a book that was written by my two friends, Ronald McDonald and Robert Rowan. And the book's title is entitled They Own It All. I would recommend a reading to everyone because it gets right down to the basics. And you can thank Mr. Roosevelt with his 6102 executive order when they recalled all the metal. And it could happen again. So I like John's advice and beware. And you all take care.
Well, thank you. Thank you, sir. Let me just wait for my phone to refresh again. You know, just on an aside, while I've got you here, Johnny Ringo, I have Tony Davis's hard drive. Did I tell you that?
Yeah, I've got it also.
Okay.
I've got three young individuals that are very good on the computer, and when Tony disappeared, they were able to obtain his total hard drive off of his machine. They copied it, and so yeah, we've. We've got all the information. It's just a matter of getting people to acknowledge it. Let's put it that way. About a year and a half ago, I had went to D.C. and I had 30-some senators and a couple of representatives in a meeting. And I furnished them some of the information, not all of it. I was not yet to them. Right. And they were all kind of mystified, and they all agreed that something should be done. But just like everything else in Washington, nothing gets done.
Right.
So they are aware of it, but I don't believe it'll go anywhere. But the Justice Department has issued a memorandum not to employ Title 18 under any circumstances, but I don't know how far that's going to go.
Well, the problem with that is the all of the cases, all of the history of the people that are in jail or have died because of Title 18.
Yeah, Molesky and I've got his entire case, and I've talked to his brother several times on the situation. And like I've got sworn affidavits from administrative magistrates. Matter of fact, four different magistrates. And we've got 20 years of research into this, and it's beyond conclusion. It does not exist, but they will not acknowledge it because it's a dollar value to them, and that's as far as
Correct.
It goes.
Correct. All right, well, thank you so much, Johnny Ringo, and I appreciate all the efforts that you do. I look forward to you returning soon to our calls. Brian, you're next, followed by Kent.
Hello, Michael.
Brian.
Hello, John.
There
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Hey, John. Brian is the gentleman that I was talking to you about on the traffic issue the other day, and where the court just steamrolled over him. I had regarding status and any of that. I had forwarded you that information. I was just thinking that a motion for reconsideration might be in order, just to share with you.
Yeah, that's I need to dig into one more, or actually two more aspects of that, and then we need to sit down with Brian again. Brian, we need to have a moment, you and Michael and I, where we can discuss and discuss what happened. I'd like to get a little – thank you for forwarding that summary. That was very good. I'd like to chat with you a little bit more on that. There's more and more we're finding people that members of the bench and the prosecutors respond sometimes very differently than anything we've ever seen before. To that end, we, you know, figuring out a response for that is very, very important. And to that end, being educated and primed is also extremely important. One thing about the that I hardly encourage anybody who's considering getting their status change, try to do it before you get stopped, you know, so that you've got your documentation ready. What's happening is that it's significant, probably more than a third or half the individuals who get stopped for most different infractions. The constabulary apologize to them, thanks them for their time, and ask them to either slow down or come to a complete stop next time they come through that area, or not try to rush through the light, and they don't even give them a warning. When it comes to the bench, some of them, then man makes God in his own image, and Brian, that's kind of what seems a little bit what happened with you. Still there, Brian?
Yes, sir. I am, and I'm wondering what you mean by that.
The bench believes that they know more than we do. They've got authority, and they wield it quite. They just casually disregard important points of law.
Yes, sir. Saw that empirically.
Yeah, you're probably more painfully clear on that concept than most of us tonight.
I apologize for interrupting, but there were many mistakes I made. You know, in the pretrial, I should have done some things that I didn't, and then I tried to readdress those in a trial phase, and so I wasn't under the. There were many failures on my part, so I see why this is so hard for y'all to educate people on, especially, you know, when you're walking them through this remotely, if you will.
Well, the object here, Brian, is to for us to impart to you as much as we can to help you be able to take care of you. If I give a man a fish, I fed a man for a day, but if I teach a man to fish, I fed a man for life. If we teach you how to fish and how to deal with the jurisprudent aspects of just day-to-day visits to the courthouse, then you not only are taken care of, but you can actually help take care of others. And so that's part of, you know, our efforts at restoring liberty to America.
Yes, sir. And this is it's absolutely magnificent what y'all are doing. And, you know, actually, the reason for raising my hand wasn't to talk about the current situation, which I'm looking forward to working with you on. But it was more towards another subject that I raised with Michael here recently, which was, you know, changing DNA and Supreme Court rulings on that. And, you know, I also understand how to dissolve those types of things from many ways. So I wanted to get your particular opinion on, you know, adjusting people's DNA with mRNA and gene therapy. That was my ultimate question, but I appreciate all of your
help. My intellectual property, I mean, my DNA is my property. I value that very, very highly, and I am absolutely not comfortable with somebody else tampering with that under any circumstances, and that includes pharmacologically under the guise of attempting to respond to a pandemic. Okay.
You are aware that the Supreme Court ruling that states that the mRNA, if it changes your DNA to what they're loading into you, if you would, or uploading into you, that becomes the intellectual property of Moderna or Johnson & Johnson, whomever the vax is. And in effect, you have become the intellectual property. Your body has become the intellectual property of the vax maker.
And to run off of that, supposedly this is the new equity or the new collateral that they're looking forward to leveraging because they have ownership for the new global currency. So that was a really weird twist that I heard. That was like, man, this ties into so many things that y'all talk about. It disturbed me.
Don't worry, it's much worse than you think. They have mRNA. They have mRNA strains that are already matched to weaponized viruses that are designed to exclusively eradicate the specific mRNA strain.
I believe that, but also I'm paying attention to self-dissemination. You know, they're claiming they're going to put vaccines in salads, yeah, with foods and whatever, but
sky too.
Yeah, so it's to really analyze here and a lot of, you know, decision to make.
You still shop at Whole Foods or Trader Joe's?
No.
I try to stay at organic level, but you know that might be diminishing, you know, here in the near future. But going to local groups here is what I'm, you know, trying to do. Going to farmers markets and things like that.
All right, Brian. Thank you. Kent is next, followed by Tommy, and then followed by Michael. Anything else, Brian, before we move on?
No, sir. Thank you. Thank you, John.
Thank you, sir.
Take care,
go ahead,
Brian.
Kent.
Good evening, Mike. Good evening, John.
Good evening, Mike.
Good night.
Okay, you can hear me? Good. John, I originally had two questions, but I want to add something to what Brian just said. If you were compelled, if you were compelled in order to obtain a certain medical stress test to have a COVID test, would you have any concerns that that swab of your nasal passage might contain something that would alter your DNA, or that they might be trying to do something other than what they're claiming?
My my brother is a senior resident for CCU and ICU at County UCLA Medical Center, and they're required to take swab 3 times a week. He pretends to stick it up his nose, spits on it, pretends to stick it up his nose, and then rubs it into the swab and then puts it back in the sample. They get a successful sample, but there's no interaction. Under no circumstances will my brother, he said, if they for, you know, the first time they say that they want to push the swab up there is the day that he thanks them for their time and he retires. Does mm-hmm. that answer your question?
Well, sort of, but they're saying that they no longer push the swab up into the top of the nasal passage. They just touch it at the bottom of the nasal passage and pick up whatever they can. I questioned them in detail on this.
Now, are you addressing or ignoring the fact that there are some allegations that the swabs have been pre-treated with sample material that it leaves resident in the sinus or nasal passage when it's there taking the swab, when they're taking the sample?
I'm addressing that rather than ignoring that fact. They're
okay.
Ignoring it. I don't really trust anything they tell me, so.
As you so carefully pointed out, I cannot, I'm not comfortable with there's sufficient, information and evidence, that indicates that, at no single time should you ever consider using one of those swabs that go all the way up the nasal passage. Do the blood test.
They told me there's no blood test and they will not do a saliva test.
Now, who's telling you that?
The charge nurse at the facility.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you very well. Say it again.
The charge nurse, the nurse practitioner.
Okay. They're dead wrong. My son is a distributor for the rapid test, blood test.
Okay. All right. I'll go back
yes.
to him and talk. I'll go back to him and talk to him again. Thank you for that answer. My other question, well, I have two more questions, actually. You were talking about the Corporation Soul. And, of course, Bernie talks about the listing of what the specific listing that you turn in, and I believe that also goes to the state, regarding the items that the Corporation Soul now owns. And I understand the reason for that, but at the same time, I'm very skeptical, and this almost reminds me of what was being done back in the late 90s when people were all charged up about listing the ownership of your items on a UCC-1 form and proceeding down that track, where, in fact, you were giving away a lot of information. And some people were willing to do that when they filed those UCC forms. Now, while I understand that the Corporation Soul is a far cry away from the UCC form, you're still dealing with the state. And while I understand Bernie's reason for wanting to file with the state, which he again made very plain this past Saturday night in his call, it seems to me, I don't know, I just have a question as to whether or not that's a good idea to list every last asset on a form that's going to the state. Can you just comment on that?
Yes, there's presently to date, I've had the dubious honor and privilege of being aware of multiple cases where a state individual says, wait a minute, you can't touch that, it's listed here. And so to that end, California, Washington, Wyoming, and Montana have been four situations that that I'm personally aware of where somebody said, a state official says, it's on this itemization. It belongs to the corporation. That doesn't go with us.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you think, so you're actually saying, I'm not putting words in your mouth, but I think you're actually saying that the positive chance that something could happen and having it listed far outweighs the negative point that I may view in putting it there to begin with.
Exactly. I used to refrain from itemizing, shall we say, too much or anything at all. There are some things where I want to make sure that it is that, and I filled out one of those lists today for a corporation sold. I was working on one of those just 3 hours ago, I put some very, very critical, expensive things on there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, including a vehicle, a sea land container with its contents, it's things like that, with the serial number for that sea land container.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
Does that help at all?
Well, you know, I understand your point. I understand Bernie's point. I just feel like providing that information, there's something that sticks in my craw about that, but, I guess I'll have to get over it.
Nope. You don't have to get over it. Don't ever get over it. Don't. Listen, there is nothing that's the only thing that's absolute in life is death and taxes. That's not true. There are a lot of other things. But if something is triggering a question mark or warning sign, always, always, always listen to that. You may make a judgment between option A or option B or option C or Carol Merrill, but what happens is that at least you weighed the concerns and the facts. Don't
mm-hmm.
ever, yeah, don't ever get over that that thing that's prompting you to, you know,
that skepticism.
Yeah, you see my point?
Yeah, I see your point. Okay. I appreciate that last comment. And my final question is, would you happen to know anything about early Illinois law that was promulgated to keep people out from under the bankster's thumb, so to speak, and how that law might have been used up until almost the present day?
Okay. I am not conversant and skilled on this question subject material.
Okay.
I have heard of that. I would love to say, yes, I have a good answer for you. What I have and what I know to date could be considered amounting nothing more than hearsay evidence.
Okay.
But at this juncture, please continue to investigate that. I am.
Okay. And would I be correct in my conclusion if you know that Illinois was likely the only state that had such laws in place?
I think to some degree there are allegations that in two other states, there was one of them 11 counties and the other 14 counties that had county laws to that effect.
Mm-hmm. Do you happen to know what those two states are?
I would have to go look them up.
Okay. All right. Well, I thank you for your comments. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. Thank you.
All righty. All right. Next is Tommy Mail. Tommy, go ahead, buddy, and then Michael.
Yes. I was wondering, I'm in the same boat as the other guy, about the federal court steamrolling you.
You know, federal court flat out called all my motions moot and flat out denied me that no as getting the grand jury transcripts. What would you do of that situation?
Actually, you and I have talked about this. Right now we've got another student that has the, one that they just got down at the appellate level, and their failure to provide the grand jury transcript is our basis for a motion for reconsideration because they failed to deliver it. Because once, you know, until a grand jury indictment is handed down, until you decide to make an affidavit and file a complaint, what you do in your own head is your business. Mm-hmm. What happens in a grand jury room before an indictment is handed down is their own business. But the moment under Article 6 of the Sixth Amendment, the moment that they hand down any kind of ruling, what happens is that the testimony and evidence, whatever applied to that, you have the right to confront anybody that contributed to testimony and evidence that they used to either invite you to a discussion before the bench or attempt to prosecute you. So what's happening is that is there a little bit of excessive background noise somewhere?
I think it's John.
No. I don't have anything on my end.
Are you?
Let me turn on my speaker. Let me turn it. It might be a feedback from my speakers.
Okay.
Okay. How's that?
That's better. Thank you. That's very, very helpful. The Sixth Amendment says, and to be informed of the nature of the cause of an accusation, be confronted with witnesses against him, and have to compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. The moment the grand jury indictment is handed down, under the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure 7B2, you have the right to even disqualify a grand juror, and to that end, you have the right to review that and have them, even a juror, recuse themselves or removed or disqualified. Now, they still can't disqualify the grand jury indictment unless they, you know, if they still have more than 12 assenting jurors, especially if it was out of a pool of 23, which is very common when they're seeking capital or felony counts that could exceed 3 to 5 years of imprisonment. So they have a larger grand jury pool to ensure that the grand jury cannot be broken or pierced, the grand jury indictment pierced. But the Sixth Amendment makes it very clear that you have a right to qualify or disqualify grand jurors. You know, and to date, Rule 7 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, I've yet to find where it says there's a statute of limitations on disqualifying a grand juror or a jury indictment. So we're trying to figure out how to get around some of these judges that one of them, after 3 attempts to obtain the grand jury transcripts before his trial, and his trial hasn't yet come up, the judge is threatening to put him in jail for 30 days if he asks again. But at this juncture, we're trying to figure out how to prosecute and proceed against this particular jurist. Tommy, we got the same problem in your case, don't we?
Yes, sir. In fact, the judge put a block on all further attempts.
Yeah.
I think he even blocked the appeals court also.
Plan on giving Michael a call on Friday, and Friday afternoon, and let's chat about this, okay?
Okay.
I think I have some time on Friday afternoon. Let's bring this up again, please.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Tommy, do you have anything else, sir, that you'd like to bring up?
Yep, that was it. Oh, yeah. I'm also waiting on my, DS-11 to return to me.
Yeah, now that you're waiting on that, and that's because I'm waiting on John to assist me with the affidavit of non-SSN.
Okay. Michael and I were heavily engaged in that this morning. In the last day or two, a couple of days, we've been working on that, throwing some attention at that. There are some things that we're trying to work out. And Tommy, on yours specifically, Michael, we may want to try to bump his appointment up to tomorrow. Because, you know, I forgot about it, that he was also waiting on that affidavit. But, Tommy, let's talk. I want to get some input from you. We may not be able to have a standard affidavit, but we're trying to see if we can get it. But I want to make sure that we cover all of the bases that apply to each individual student. I don't want to leave a student accidentally behind on something that we overlooked.
Okay. Sounds good.
Thank
tomorrow,
you.
Then.
Thank you, Tommy.
Okay.
All righty. And lastly here is Michael from Las Vegas, Nevada. Go ahead, guy.
Yeah, well, let's go back to the nose swab. They probably started the virus. Well, I know they started the virus because I already had a patent on this stuff. That this is their game. Anyway, so everybody's going to run out and get a nose swab and start testing. So you can rest assured they've infected those, put something in those swabs. But if you get H2O2 food grade, 35% and dilute it down, it'll without diluting it, it'll eat right through steel. That'll pretty well take anything out of your sinuses or any other part of your body, and that'll end the virus itself. So they can't. But yeah, their whole game is to have total control over us. And since you get an injection, you've now committed yourself to their ownership one way or the other. And then the other thing was on that, on Tommy's there, the juries, the prosecutor, the judge. You see how well that's working for Trump. They just redacted. How does that work that they take a marker and mark out all those lines of the warrant? What have they got left to go into court with? And can those lines be opened up? Can they even be seen in court? My question.
There are certain things that the moment the public has access to them that must be redacted. And that part of that is people's personal information and information that could cause a negative threat against somebody witnessing or testifying. And so those things are legally redactable. And when you, anytime you log on to a federal court website for the purpose of submitting testimony and evidence into the record, there's a box that you have to check that says, have you complied with the redaction requirements? And or it says, are you aware of and have you complied with the redaction requirements? And you can actually look up what the redaction requirements are before you log on and after you, and also after you log on. But Michael, what you do is you go to the local, just pick, you have a U.S. District Court website there for Las Vegas there. You are familiar with it?
I can look it up, yes.
Yeah. There, the look up, the PACER, public access to court system records, you know.
Yes.
Now, there's a training portion that applies to pro se or improper litigants. And under that portion there, it has the redaction policy. You don't actually have to have a PACER login to get to that. It's there to help train you before you get to it. But it's right there for pro se litigants, okay?
Okay. Yeah, that's
nice. I was on that website just a week or two ago, and I remember seeing it.
All right. Yeah, because it's just amazing to me that if you block out a whole page, who are you protecting? You know, I mean,
who are you prosecuting wrongfully?
Right. Well, you've got to keep certain people out of the pit where you can't ask them any questions, because then the cat will be out of the bag, so to speak. But
right.
The only other thing I have is Kent was asking about putting the corporation sold and in the trust and listing the assets. Well, back in the day, I can remember all the old people in Brandon, they used to all, and I never not heard them say this, okay? Don't put all your eggs in one basket. And they didn't keep their money in the bank, all them people. They had little money in the bank. But you could always.
There's a difference between keeping your nickels in the bank and keeping it in your nickels in the piggy.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you one thing. With the itemizations that are on the sheet there for the corp sol, what happens is that you'll find that the documents that occur on the property spreadsheets that you list, you'll find that they actually, for the most part, they don't just pull up with the tow truck and load your car up onto the Jardin. Because the vehicle was listed, or the car was listed on the asset spreadsheet as corp sol, they'll, for the most part, ignore it. And it's a whole lot easier to just list it and not have them pull up three Jardins and take all three vehicles away and then try to pay the impound fees, but not until you've gone to the court, paid the court costs, file suit against them, get the injunction against them, and prove and let a second set of eyes, now second judge, everything that you've got on that list, and then weigh it, decide whether they're willing to provide a court order while you're paying that attorney to get that court order and et cetera. And that car may only be worth $2,000, but it takes $3,000 to $5,000 worth of legal to get that car back out that was legally yours, and then they end up adjudicating that it's legally yours and that you can legally have it back.
Right.
Just
well,
a thought.
I
never was
yeah.
very bright, but, you know.
Well, assets that can't be readily moved. I mean, I look at automobiles or vehicles or conveyances, is they're everywhere, and you can make a deal and buy one every day of the week. So that's not
right.
something that concerns me. Something you can't readily move, you need to protect. Because if you can readily move it, they can't readily put their hands on it. anyway, one other thing is I was reading about the Amish farmer they're going after. And the Amish don't file birth certificates. They don't get Social Security numbers. So they're getting real deep in this. And if they're going after the Amish, they're not far from those 87,000 new agents literally storming into people's houses with guns drawn. Because they've been afraid of the Amish for years and the Mennonites. And they even wrote special protection for them in the OSHA codes. Amish don't have to wear a hard hat, safety-toed boots, and stuff that other people have to do. So that's pretty strong for the Amish. But still, when they're desperate for money, they're coming after the money.
Now, the Amish, they're not unique. A third of the homeschoolers here in Texas, their children don't have birth certificates. My son doesn't. He's 28. He doesn't have a social security number. He has a passport, no birth certificate, no social security number. In the old days, where were the births and the weddings always recorded?
In the Bible.
And how many witnesses?
At least two.
Two witnesses. Right. And there's a lot of folks here I've been helping the individuals without birth certificates or social security numbers get passports for years, for many, many years, 43 or 44 years now I've been working with them. And I don't have a social security number. And my passport, I just put NA religious objector. I don't even argue with it. Now, me, I don't have one because I may have used to work for the government. And at one point, to keep us alive, there was 1,173 of us that they made our social security numbers just disappear, because what was happening was the days of the Cold War, they had people that were planted in the Treasury Department and Social Security Department. When they would see individuals with similar that were getting paid, or their benefits were getting paid into or from a similar account, they were linking them together as being on the same classified project. And these folks' friends were turning up interrogated, you know, and the finger, you could tell before they took the end digit off, they sliced off a lot of the tissue and poured in colorful solutions of acid and citric acid and salts and things. And before they diked off the next joint, it was, and then there's electrical burns where there it was shocked. And, you know, and they, you could tell that they would go through 14 shades of interrogation on each hand before they moved to the proximal metacarpals, you know, in the flanges. You know, they, same thing with the toes, and individuals were turning up interrogated in more than 160 pieces before they died. And wow. you can tell that the blood was flowing when the part was amputated. Okay. By the hemorrhagic tissue. And so so for me, that was, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I may be a former conspirer, but, the individuals, how you, handle that, those Amish, I laud them. I have great respect for them. And if I had the chance to contribute or be a blessing to them, that's my honor and privilege. And to anyone who does not remand their children to the state to be raised by public schools, that they actually raise their children themselves, they maintain their own responsibilities, those children and those parents end up so smart, it's scary. My son, he is way smarter than I am. And that's not something that happened recently. He's, you know, almost from the get-go, you know, and we homeschooled him. There's going back to recording the births and deaths in the family Bible and the marriages, that's the way to go. When, you know what the etymology of the marriage license was, right? And the birth certificate.
Yep.
It was the Property and Enabling Act of 1847. It was so that property from two plantations could be joined together. Slaves. But the product of that union was property of the state, and that's why they had to have a certificate of ownership. I mean, a birth certificate. And so what happened was that that's why when you have a marriage license, that the state can, when you have a probate, that they can take a third of the assets because that is a state entity,
contract.
Your marriage. But if the marriage is recorded in the family Bible with just two witnesses, they do not have any part, and CPS doesn't have jurisdiction over the children either. And I've been in many of those cases, most of them, a large portion of them in Dallas and in Tyler, Texas, some of them here in Houston, and the remainder in California. But they, and it's a shock to the judge when you go in and prove that the state did not have, CPS did not have jurisdiction, and they have to return the children to the parents. But the judges, you know, by educating them, they're realizing what's happening. We had two CPS agents here in, child protection service agents here in Houston, a year after a case that, I had the honor and privilege of appearing in court with the family. The same judge, when they came before them, they tried to pull the same thing, and he said, I'm sorry, didn't you guys learn you were already in your, no, I'm sorry, that was a different case. No, no, the law is still the same. And he remanded both of them under contempt to 8 months custody. CPS
wow.
agents. So some of the judiciary does learn. Some of us are a little hard-headed and we don't learn very easy. And it's almost like we need, somebody has to hit me over the head with a stick, you know, for me to learn. But okay, they're going after them. Let's find out why and how they're going after them, and let's learn to fight the fight so that we can stand beside them and turn back the tide.
Yeah, I keep telling people, if you don't know how we got here, you don't know how to get the remedy. And believe me, I talk to a lot of people all over the country, and I give them the phone number to call to listen in. And a lot of them do. I know they do because I've heard them when they said their first name and Mike put it down. I know they're listening. You know, it's just a matter of getting them to act.
All righty. Thank you, Michael.
Yes, sir.
I want to add something before we bring Harold on with the last question. I don't know if you all saw this. It just came out today, as far as I know. It's the first time I saw it. That Glenn Beck shared that there's 153 pages of a confidential agreement between Moderna and the United States government that goes back to 2015. Of course, this is well before Donald Trump became president. He then goes on to say that the papers reveal that the United States government has ulterior motives in mandating the coronavirus vaccine. Quote, did you know the government co-owns the vaccine? The same government that is now mandating its used? End quote. The video was flagged as part of Facebook's effort to combat false news and misinformation on its news feeds. It is true the government owns the vaccine. He had the contract, copy of the contract in front of him when he was doing the video. That's my contribution. Next is Harold, and then I have one more thing to add that I think you all might be very, very interested in hearing. Very much.
Okay.
Harold, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to know, where can we hear just so much excellent information? Where can we hear
This call and on Monday night calls, Monday night and Tuesday night calls, where can we hear those?
Okay, sure. The website dedicated for it is AmericanByBirth.com. AmericanByBirth.com. That website has been under constant attack for the last 7 months. And I learned only for ransomware, by the way, I learned only today. I've hired a new programmer to add to the programmer that I've got, who basically is wanting to retire. So when I learned that, that's when I went out shopping. But the point is that the architecture of everything that I have is basically 15 years old. And because of that, a fifth grader can hack the websites, never mind anybody brilliant. So this new new IT guy is his first focus is going to be on upgrading correctmystatus.com, which is redirects to American by Birth, and I also just bought the URL Union State Citizen because that's the term that was used on an older W-8 Ben form. That's interesting. Anyways, anything else, Harold?
Is there a charge for these to go and listen to them?
No. We try to do everything as inexpensive and free as possible. The only time that you get it gets costly, and that is comparatively against attorneys is cheap, is when you actually hire an information provider to take you by the hand and walk you through legal issues that you have.
So we can refer people to those calls even though they're past.
Oh, yeah, but I'm just letting you know that you can't. I just tried this morning to listen to an archive.
No, I know that.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, but we can refer people to the calls.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, please. I plead with everyone. Share this call. Give them the phone number and PIN for tonight's call. Tell them to be on Monday, Tuesday, and Saturday for sure. Those are live calls. Wednesday and Thursday right now are recorded calls. Okay?
But they can go and listen to the recorded calls.
Well, it doesn't work, but that's where it is, and that's once we get it fixed, that's where they can listen to it. Yes.
Once it gets fixed, yeah. Okay. All right. Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, thank you. This is what I want to share with everyone before we close it down tonight. Donald Trump, before he left office, well, actually, in the midst of his run of office, on Executive Order 13848, he signed September 12, 2018, that a national emergency would begin November 3rd, 2020. In 2018, he signed an EO that a national emergency was to begin on November 3rd, 2020, and it was to bring in maritime law. Question is, how did POTUS Trump know to issue this to go into effect 2 years later? He also signed these other executive orders. 13885, he signed on September 2021, the National Quantum Act. Go to quantum.gov. It's called the Quantum Initiative. He signed the Executive Order 13959. He signed that on November 12th, 2021. Any funding of the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, will have their assets frozen. That was what the EO was. And following that week, there was over 1,300 CEOs of major companies that either retired or were fired. And he also has a signature on Executive Order 13919, which is after the Congress did not prosecute President Trump's executive orders, bringing all National Guards into full activation in all the states. So when somebody asks you who is the president today, these these EOs were signed in 2021. Anyways, I just wanted to share that with you. So yeah, I gave you the numbers. Go look it up. John, anything else? Anything that you'd like to share that you may be privy to with your clandestine friends?
I don't have any clandestine friends. I'm just some dumb jamoke that happened through. There's an old saying that says you should know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. May all of you continue to seek to pursue the truth. The term jurisprudence is a title given to those who enjoy the hobby or pursuit of the study of law. May you all find joy in learning about that which governs us. There's a brief that's going to be coming out shortly that makes a comment that out of the 17,834 statutes that range from federal all the way down to individual city statutes regarding the prohibition of guns or firearms, and the 2,784 opinions from appellate level courts that are codified into case law regarding firearms or the carry of, etc. The one single question you can ask in a court of law is, Your Honor, where in the Constitution is excluded my right to keep bear a firearm in that school zone, or let alone your courtroom? All of that 17,854 and the 2,784 case law statutes are all now revealed to be null and void under Marbury versus Madison, 1803, Second Branch, 179. So we're learning some things fast, okay? If you know the truth shall set you free. In a couple of weeks, we may have a brief to share that also covers the income tax and something that you'll be able to share with your friends. In fact, it'll be so shockingly simple that your first thing that'll probably happen is you'll probably become very angry before you get excited, when you realize how stupidly simple it is that we're not subject to the income tax. So from time to time, we're going to be bringing little academic educational events out on the on this call. Thank you for being here. It's an honor and a privilege to share what we can for your academic benefit. Pete, God's peace be upon you.
Thank you, everybody, for us. See you Saturday. Don't forget, tomorrow and Thursday both have recorded calls. You can listen to them, and it's some interesting stuff on that as well. Until then, good night, everybody, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you.